The docket.
Alaska America Corporation, etc., named zoning administrator of the city of Chesapeake, Robert W. McFarland, Rebecca Gant, Ryan G. C. Dowery, Robert W. Lawson, the appellant, Ryan C. Samuel, assistant city attorney for the appellate.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Robert McFarland, McGuire Woods, for appellate Boasso Corporation, doing business as Greensville Transportation Company. With me at council table is my colleague and co-counsel, Rebecca Gant. We would like to reserve 3 minutes, Your Honors, for rebuttal.
All right.
We are here this morning, Your Honor, asking this court to reverse the Chesapeake Circuit Court's final order of November 4, 2015, which denied Greenville's motion for leave to amend its petition for writ and granted the zoning administrator's motion to dismiss the city attorney's and the acting city clerk's pleas in bar. The circuit court erroneously held that it lacked jurisdiction to exercise its discretion and grant Greensville's motion for leave based on its application of this court's February 2015 order in Frace versus Johnson, as it applied to Virginia Code Section 15.2-2314.
Well, the court, you would concede, I expect, did lack active jurisdiction, though it obviously had subject matter jurisdiction.
It definitely had subject matter jurisdiction, Your Honor, and what Frey said is that the failure to comply with the 30-day requirement or the noticing the parties is active jurisdiction.
Well, the adjectives are important because the fact that there's active jurisdiction gives the court the power to do things, and it can't be upset after the fact for lack of any subject matter jurisdiction. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the statutory precondition is not mandatory. There are many mandatory procedural requirements, which admit to no exceptions whatsoever, that actually do not implicate subject matter jurisdiction.
There are, Your Honor, but when they are mandatory and they would foreclose the right to amend, the General Assembly in the statute at issue here, 15.2-2314, would have spelled that out. We certainly know that when the General Assembly believes that there should not be an amendment or a way to correct a technical error, which is what this is a technical error in the sense of omitting to name somewhere in the body of the pleading the governing body here, the Chesapeake City Council. But the legislature, when you look at 15.2-2314, even in the 2010 amendment, it did not say that the failure to name a party is fatal. What it said was, and the real purpose of the 2010 amendment, was to clarify that the Board of Zoning Appeals is not a true party to the action, and noting who those parties are. But in this case, Your Honor, once we timely filed the petition for writ and styled it correctly, the court had, and Frey says this, the court had active subject matter jurisdiction. Therefore, the circuit court, when the issue was raised about not specifically naming the governing local body, when that issue was raised, we immediately moved the governing local body and we moved for leave to amend.
What's the outer limit to, because your opponents argue, well, there's going to be delays and gamesmanship and so on. Is it a year to serve the governing body?
Well, I think there's two principles here, Your Honor, or 2 points. The outer limit would be the year under Rule 3:5 for service. But remember, this motion is judged by the standards of a leave to amend, should it be granted, and of course the rule talks
about. So there's two layers. There's the
exactly.
Rule and the statute.
I think the 1 year service is but I can see a circuit court if for some reason, and I don't know off the top of my head what it would be, but if for some reason someone waited almost a year to move for leave to amend to add the governing body, and the petition for writ had proceeded down the line, I think that might be a different circumstance. What we have here is the petition for writ was filed. We actually gave notice to the circuit clerk of the circuit court asking what is the status for the issuing of the writ, copied the Chesapeake City attorney for the governing body, approximately a month after we first filed the petition for writ. So they were on notice at least within a month. And then when the writ was issued, the next day they filed, on behalf of the zoning administrator, filed a motion to dismiss. We immediately undertook service on the governing body, and we immediately moved for leave to amend. That's much different from the situation in Frakes, where neither of those steps was taken. And so I think when we look at what is the principle here, understandably the governing body wants to have notice of the proceedings. So you need to name them at some point. But in this case, there's no prejudice to the governing body. At a later situation, City Council, through its legal counsel, was aware of this proceeding on June 24th, again, approximately 30 days from when we filed the petition for writ. And there was no delay.
And to the extent the locality is concerned about this, there's the filing of the cert petition doesn't operate as a stay. I mean, they can continue enforcing
absolutely.
To light a fire under some recalcitrant litigant.
Absolutely, Your Honor. If there were, we did not move for a stay in this case, but that can be done. But absolutely, they would certainly obviously get notice of a motion for stay for those proceedings. So here I think we've got two important points. We've got the statute itself, amended in 2010, doesn't, by the wording of the statute, and I'll say it's not perhaps the most aptly drafted or tightly drafted statute, but what it doesn't do, when the legislature sought to amend and clarify, because there was apparently a concern that zoning administrators or BZAs were necessary parties, and what would they do and how would they participate and would they have to have legal counsel, it clarified that in 2010, and it clarified who the parties were. But it didn't say that if you don't specifically name the governing body at that time, that that's a fatal flaw.
Well, the part I'm missing in that argument is usually mandatory procedural requirements that are not subject matter jurisdiction defaults don't go to that extent. You just infer from the fact that it's a purely statutory nature to the procedural default that it's over, that the authority of the court is over. Now, the court can accept a waiver, or the court can mistakenly grant leave, and it won't cause the whole proceeding in the end to be void. But is there authority that says that a mandatory statutory procedural requirement can always be amended, but if it can't be, it has to be expressly stated in the statute? I'm just not familiar with that.
Well, I think if it's not subject matter jurisdiction, and the statute doesn't foreclose amendment, then you've got to look to the rules of the Supreme Court of Virginia, which govern this as a circuit court action, and they would govern there and say that you can still have the amendment. So it admittedly is under a slightly different process, but the Crutchfield case under the Virginia Administrative Process Act, there was not the naming of the governing body within 30 days, and yet when there was later a motion for leave to amend to add the governing body, and the court accepted that and said that was fine. In fact, what the court is saying is you want to adjudicate, and I think there's a real policy implication here, you want to adjudicate these cases, which are obviously of great importance both to the property owner and the governing body, you want to adjudicate them on the merits, not on the fact that initially within 30 days you omitted to specifically say, and by the way, the governing body here is a party. That's not getting to the merits. And so I think there's a real policy implication.
Counsel, don't the rules on amendment anticipate that there is a party named? They don't anticipate that you file a pleading with no party named and then later add parties, do they?
Well, no, but it specifically says 15.2-2314 still says you style it in re.
Right, but the style doesn't name the party. It specifically says the BZA is not a party.
Well, the statute now clarifies that the BZA isn't a party, but what the statute still says, even after the amendment, is that you serve the BZA, and then when the writ is granted, like the circuit court prepares the record, etc. So you've got, under the statutory procedure, that's what was followed here, with the absence of, admittedly, not specifically including.
But I guess my question is, you're relying on the rules of court which allow you to add a party, but don't those rules anticipate that there is presently in the body of the pleading a party already named?
Well, you've got, I mean, and this is a somewhat unique process, Your Honor, right, because we're dealing with an appeal petition for writ. You've got, in a sense, initially a party in name, which is the Board of Zoning Appeals. Now, they're not a true party. They're going to drop out once the writ is granted and we get to the actual appeal on the merits. But they're in there initially, and what was previously done prior to the 2010 amendment is, once the writ would be issued, then you'd serve the entire writ, record, etc., on the governing body, and so proceed. What Frey seemed to indicate is that you should now name the governing body from the get-go within the 30 days. But I say, I don't think Frey is, the failure to do so is not a subject matter jurisdictional defect.
But I think that's a given. I don't know why the briefs circulate around that point so thoroughly. Of course it's not. Our opinion says it's not.
Right.
But that begs the question. The question in my mind is, we have an active jurisdiction procedural requirement. It seems very specific. It comes from a statute, not a rule of court. We've explained it within the last year, and it seems like what we're really doing here, from your point of view, is deciding whether or not we can allow trial judges to set it aside at their discretion. I would expect the statute to say that, as opposed to your expectation, which is this, you would expect it to say it can't.
Right, Your Honor. I think that when you're going to foreclose the right to proceed on the merits, certainly the General Assembly knows how to do that in the circumstances.
Well, they said it. You have to do this within 30 days. That's pretty clear.
You have to file it in 30 days, right. Your Honor. Correct. And you have to style it as such. But what it doesn't say is the failure to name the governing body is a death knell. Statute doesn't say that. And even this court, in its order, with Frey's, said, well, in this case, we note that.
But why do you have to swing for the fences for some broad principle? Because here you have a specific statute that says, here's how you style the thing, here's who you serve initially, and so you do that, and then you default to those principles of, well, you got a year, and you've got the rule, and so on, to amend, etc. So why isn't it just, that's how we interpret this statute against the backdrop of these rules?
I think that's correct.
All right.
I see that my
Paul, before head. You sit down, the standard of review is often a pivotal issue before us. You have alleged that the circuit court erred, which means erred as a matter of law, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. On the granting of the motions, yes.
Right. But when you inject the question of prejudice into the analysis, does that change it to an abuse of discretion?
I think on a pure amendment, it would be an abuse of discretion, except that we're applying the precedential aspect here of the statute and the case law. So I think that makes it also a question of law.
So is finding of prejudice or lack thereof an issue in the case?
Well, I think in this case, Your Honor, there is no prejudice.
Well, I know, but I'm talking about the legal principle. You've injected it into the analysis, and I'm just wondering whether or not by doing that you've changed it from a legal error to a discretionary call.
Well, remember, what the circuit court said is it didn't even have authority to rule on the motion for leave to amend because of Frey.
I know what they said. I'm talking about what you said.
Right. And
you injected prejudice into this.
And in that sense, Your Honor, it would be an abuse of discretion. But they didn't. But that isn't the basis for the circuit court's ruling.
All right. You have a minute 27 left.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Ryan Samuel and I represent the appellees in this matter. And Your Honors, what's at issue here today is whether Greensville Transport can ignore the statutory requirements of 15.2.23.14 and still proceed with perfecting their appeal. And the circuit court got it right. You can't do that. As this court ruled in Trace v. Johnson, the first three paragraphs of 15.2.23.14 govern how you institute an appeal of a BZA decision. And to ignore that third paragraph, which states who the necessary parties are, and not give notice to them, not name them, name no parties at all, would render that paragraph superfluous.
Isn't that a matter of timing? In other words, it's not that they're saying we should never give notice and we can just proceed unilaterally. They're just saying statute says here's how you style it, here's who you serve, and then within a year or within the intendment of the rule, we have to proceed in that way to make sure the necessary party is properly brought in. What's wrong with that?
Well, Your Honor, the statute in the first paragraph says this has to be done in 30 days. And so the General Assembly has spoken to that this needs to be done within 30 days, and the necessary parties are spelled out who those necessary parties need to be within 30 days. We are talking about a necessary party that we didn't realize needed to be in, and we're 60 days into the case, then that'd be a different story. But the statute here states that City Council is a necessary party. It's very clear they have to be named in the petition or served within 30 days. And I disagree that this is a technical error. I think this is a substantive one. As this court said in Gamshely, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right, the Commonwealth 279, Virginia 379, 2010 case, dismissal of an untimely appeal is not merely a mechanical application of a technical rule to deprive the litigant of the right to appeal. Rather, the purpose of the specific time limit is not to penalize the appellant, but to protect the appellee. And I think that's what happened here when the circuit court issued its order. I mean, there was a writ entered in this case with no necessary parties being named. I think that's a pretty serious thing to have a writ entered that we would have disputed and had no opportunity to do so. And I don't think that there hasn't been prejudice shown. I don't think that's part of this analysis, but I think there's clear prejudice. That writ was entered. They have a significant period of time. If you rule that you can amend this, and I don't think the rules of court can abrogate a statute, but they can amend this, what's the limit? How long can you wait before you need to serve the necessary parties? And that can give you a distinct advantage. You have that time to plan out how you're going to prosecute your appeal. And the governing body would have no notice that there is an appeal pending. So I think there is clear prejudice.
Was there, whenever the default, procedural default exists, the argument is always, well, the other side wasn't really hurt. There's no prejudice. But that presupposes that we don't examine the defaulter's conduct. And typically, the test is excusable or inexcusable neglect. You don't even get to prejudice until you determine that. In this case, was there any proffer or showing of excusable neglect? That is, a mistake was made and it's understandable and it can be excused, as opposed to inexcusable neglect, which is a mistake is made and that's because they didn't read the statute.
Your Honor, I would say this is inexcusable. When the statute's clear, I don't think it's hard to read. It says who the necessary parties are.
Right, but it says necessary parties to the proceedings in the circuit court. And then the cert petition talks about the initiation of the proceedings, and cert deals with records and bringing forth the records. So you got cert, which is let's bring up the file from the BZA, and then you have the proceedings, which is argument and so on. So why don't we just follow the statute and say, well, there wasn't really a proceeding in the sense of argument and a disposition. All we're talking about is a petition to for cert and to bring the records up. What does the City Council care about that?
Well, there's already been a proceeding. So the zoning administrator has already had to go and investigate whether there's a violation. That takes time and effort. And then there's an appeal to the Board of Zoning Appeals, and it's in the record that shows there were witnesses. There's a huge amount of effort that goes into that. And then we're entitled to believe that it's over. There isn't an appeal filed within 30 days. We're entitled to believe the litigation is concluded. And this court has said that the
right... But that's sort of circular. That presupposes that you had to be brought in at the cert petition level, and then you weren't brought in, therefore prejudice. So answering the statutory interpretation answers the prejudice question, doesn't it?
Well, I think the first three paragraphs, what this court said in phrase, is right, that it would render the third paragraph superfluous if you say that it doesn't have to be done within 30 days.
Right.
Your Honor, if there's no other questions, that's my argument.
All right. Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, I think it's important to note the appeal was timely filed. It was filed within 30 days of the BZA decision, and it was styled correctly. It just didn't specifically name the governing body.
Suppose there's a notice of appeal from the circuit court to our court, and it leaves out a necessary party, and we discover it months later. Would we have the authority to add a necessary party to a notice of appeal that was not identified in the notice of appeal?
Well, in the Highland case, this court's kind of left open that question, but said under those circumstances, no, it would. They were not going to permit it.
Why is this terribly different from your case? Because that's really what's happening. Of course, you filed a document within 30 days, but the document didn't name the necessary party. And it is a proceeding. It's obviously a proceeding. Petition for a writ is a proceeding. And it's a continuation of a proceeding that preexisted the appeal to the circuit court. So we have, and then we have our order, a published order, saying that. Why is that analogy I just gave not the same thing as the one you're dealing with?
I think it's a different procedural process, Your Honor. Remember, until this court's decision in Frace, which clarified the statute's 2010 amendment, we proceeded exactly as everyone had been doing, in the sense of you specifically added the governing body once the writ was issued. And so the difference is below, and if I may finish Your Honor's question, that's in the circuit court proceeding. In an appeal to this court, that party has always been involved in those proceedings. And so not naming it would cause it to think, hey, wait a minute, we must not, for whatever reason, we're not part of this appeal. And it happens sometimes with co-defendants. Plaintiff may decide when they get an adverse verdict that they're going to appeal this to two of the three co-defendants, but not the third. That's not this situation here. We are going to get to the merits, the meat of the case, once the writ is issued. And in this case, the governing body was well aware of all that. We said to them, if they didn't know it from monitoring the docket, they certainly knew what was going on when we sent them a copy of our letter to the clerk saying, hey, what's the status of the issuance of the writ? So there's no prejudice here. They would have had a full opportunity to participate in this case and defend. It's not that somehow, because we didn't name them in the body, the case went along and they didn't have a chance to defend the BZA decision. We never got to that, simply because we admitted one lie.
All right, your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the chance to answer the question.
Call the next case.